Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang Dhammang Sanghang Namassami. So I think today marks the end of the fourth week of the Vasa retreat so far. So I guess that's correct, isn't it? So we're a third of the way through the Vasa retreat. And an opportunity just to reflect initially on the passing of time. It's something that is unstoppable. The passing of time when it's measured in that way. And it's an interesting thing to reflect on in terms of the passing of time in our lives, growing from youth to middle age to old age, passing of time in the seasons, passing of time in the society, passing of time in the day from morning to night. And the encouragement to reflect on anicca, which is this, part of anicca is this principle of change, this quality of change in the conditioned world. So in one sense it feels unstoppable in terms of these aggregates are subject to change. And, Tara was just mentioning about the thinking mind, how fast the thinking mind can change. It's kind of probably the thing that changes the most quickly. In fact, I think there's somewhere in the suttas the Buddha talks about the changeable nature of this mind, how it's almost impossible to say how fast it can change. And yet the Buddha is pointing to a truth to be realized that is unaging, unchanging, undying, the deathless, the unconditioned reality. And I think this is a very important thing to recollect in our practice, because we can be swept up a lot in these processes of change and changing processes, which we call our life or this body or this mind or the world. We can be swept up in it and swept along in it. And indeed the Buddha encourages us to investigate this experience of the changing nature of this mind, this body, this world. But it's all in order to realize the deathless, the unchanging, the undying, the unconditioned. So this is important to remember, that this is something that he declared quite strongly. In one of his famous stanzas, there is the unborn, uncreated, unconditioned and unformed. If there weren't, there would be no escape from the born, the created, the conditioned, the formed. But since there is this unborn, uncreated, unconditioned, unformed, there is an escape from the born, the created, the conditioned and the formed. I find it's really important and really helpful to recollect this strong declaration. Particularly as we practice in this tradition where it's really emphasized to contemplate the changing characteristic of the conditioned experience and the not-self characteristic and the dukkha characteristic. These are things we need to come to understand, we need to come to recognize in relation to the conditioned world, our conditioned experience. This is what wisdom develops through recognizing these characteristics of existence, these three characteristics more and more. But I find it's important to recognize and recollect that the Buddha is also pointing to this unconditioned reality, which is actually stable, called it undying, unaging, unshakable, and that which can be realized. So one of the reasons why I find this helpful to recollect is it actually brings up a certain resonance of stability within my own practice. It somehow to help stabilize my awareness in the present. That there is that which can be realized here and now, which is not changing, which is not bound in time, which indeed is timeless. We can actually, when we read the Buddha's teachings, we recognize that this reality is understood with wisdom. It's penetrated with wisdom. And it's penetrated with this very consciousness, this very awareness, which is conjoined with wisdom, that comes to know this reality. So that which can know this reality is also that which knows the conditioned, the aging, the changing, conditioned reality. It's the same wisdom, it's the same wisdom conjoined with consciousness that can come to know, understand the conditioned and the unconditioned. So what does that do to your mind when you reflect on that? To me, it gives me some confidence to establish my mindfulness centered in awareness in this very experience of being. We might not fully understand the Buddha's path or the Buddha's teachings yet. We may indeed feel quite confused at times and quite overwhelmed at times with the various experiences we move through. But if we remember that this very awareness and the cultivation of mindfulness conjoined with wisdom, this is what can know the truth. It's helpful to keep bringing that to mind, bringing that to the fore, because in our day-to-day practice, our meditation practice, as well as our daily living, we do need to find a place of centeredness within, that we can develop a certain amount of confidence and trust. To develop this practice. So sometimes we talk about it as mindfulness, establishing the foundations of mindfulness. But I've been reflecting a lot on the languaging in this retreat when I do some of my own study and readings of the translated texts of the Buddha's teachings. And reflecting how difficult it can be sometimes to really get a handle on what the Buddha is purported to have said, because of the languaging and semantics that are used to convey his teachings. Particular words that don't necessarily relate to our everyday experience or our cultural conditioning, our education, the kind of words that we often have to work really hard to try to understand what is this pointing to. So it's helpful to keep coming back within, and you know, this is an ongoing process, to recognize the Buddha is not pointing out anything other that can be known that's outside of this body-mind. It's within our very experience that he's pointing to. So sometimes this word, you know, establish the foundations of mindfulness on the body, we can learn what that means and gradually develop an understanding of that. But how does that work, you know, reflect? How is it working for us in our practice? Mindfulness, be mindful. What does that really mean? One translator has chosen to use the word to translate sati as carefulness, because he finds that the word carefulness actually gives more of a sense of what's implied with mindfulness, which adds another nuance. Others will talk about the essence of mindfulness as being attention or what's the other word, kind of alertness. But what is it for you? What is it for us? What is this? What does it mean to be mindful? Mindful is quite an abstract, mindfulness is quite an abstract noun in a way. What does being mindful mean to you? For me, when I recollect on that, reflect on that, it just brings me directly back already to the body, to an inherent awareness that's already present. And then within that, when I contemplate what is mindfulness, I recognize there is that which can pay attention to what's happening within this field of awareness, within this field of what I'm aware of. So there's this awareness, and there's the ability to pay attention to different aspects, to different experiences within that field. Awareness in my experience is quite broad, it's quite all round, but attention is something more focused. You can choose to pay attention to the sensation in your knee, or choose to pay attention to the sound of my voice, or choose to pay attention to one's own discursive thinking that's happening, or choose to pay attention to the sound of a train running by. Or maybe that's not so much of a conscious choice, but attention is pulled due to whatever habit of mind is drawing it. But beginning to explore these different factors within your own experience, and when we're encouraged to develop what's called mindfulness of body within the field of awareness, you can be aware of various aspects of this bodily experience. And within that, you can subtly direct attention or not. You can maintain a general awareness of the whole body, or you can kind of, the attention is a bit like a zoom lens on a camera, isn't it? You can kind of focus on in. And that focusing on in is part of an act of what we might call concentration, or beginning to apply more effort to focus on one point. And this is part of the exercise of developing samadhi, kind of focusing on one area. But you can still draw out the zoom lens and check out the context within which this is happening, and then zoom back in. This is the different mental faculties that we can explore and experience, and all of these has something to do with sati, and maybe sati is a lot more than that as well. There's different takes on what sati might be. Sati is also connected to its original root meaning, which is related to memory, being able to recollect something, which is also related to perception. But sati can recollect what you're intending to do in this moment, and not just kind of zoning out altogether, or maybe one zones out for a few minutes, but sati comes back and says, "Oh, hang on, come back to watching the breath or watching the body." But within all of this, there is that which can watch, there is that which can know, there is that which can observe. Even as we sit ourselves out in nature to observe the birds, that's sati. That's mindfulness there. And we notice this capacity, when you reflect on what's happening, the mind can actually go quite still when you're observing something. I was reflecting on this morning, and I went for an early walk to the lookout, and just focusing in on the distant mountains and seeing a colony of cockatoos there and the mist rising. And just the scene allowed, just focusing in on the particulars, somehow allowed the mind to go quite still. My internal experience of thinking, or so just noticing, and then noticing what's happening to the mind. So if one's mind can go quite still in observing things in nature, and we have to recognize it can do similarly when we observe something internally. If we choose to observe a sensation, or observe the mood of the mind, or observe the passing thoughts of the mind, or the process of thinking itself, it's a little bit harder to really observe because we get caught in the content of the thoughts. So play with this ability to pay attention to how the thinking mind gets triggered. I mean, many of the Buddha's teachings, actually, there's this word that he uses, yoniso manasikara. And manasikara is attention. And yoniso is, it typically gets translated, the whole word, as wise attention or wise reflection or thorough reflection or thorough consideration. But yoniso is related to, one of its literal meanings is womb. So one could say, or origin or matrix. So one could say really it's the kind of attention goes back to the origin, or sees something within its whole matrix of coming into existence. Attention that goes back to the source of something. So this is the best kind of attention to use with the thinking mind. If you're having a lot of thoughts, don't observe the thoughts in terms of the content, but turn your attention to look back at where these thoughts are arising from. And you can do that in several ways. You could do that, you know, immediately just look at the mind, the space of the mind itself, awareness itself. Determined to, like a cat at a mouse hole, determined to watch. You know how interested cats are when they're at a mouse hole? Determined to watch where the next thought comes from. Where is its origin? I'm going to catch this thought when it comes out, like a cat's determined to grab that mouse when it comes out. I've done this before. If you're really watching, thoughts don't arise like that wise little mouse. He knows the cat's out there. He's not going to come out. But you lose your mindfulness for a moment and whoosh, out the thoughts scurry. And I think in the Chinese Chan practice they have a way of talking about this, about, I think I may be mistaken, something about catching the head of the dragon or the head of the thought rather than the tail of the thought. So if we're just looking at our thoughts chasing their tails, you know, we haven't got it. We're just running with them, you know. But if you're there when the thought first sticks its head out, you've got it. It doesn't go anywhere. As long as your attention is there. So that's one way to poise your attention at the mind door, determined. If you're really interested, where does thinking come from? I'm going to be there to watch where that next thought arises. And just notice what happens with your mind. So another way to trace or have attention go back to the source is that, you know, often these thoughts or lines of thinking we get caught up in are triggered by just a sense contact, either a sight, a sound, a smell, a taste, a sensation, or another thought, or a perception, or a feeling tone. So that's another thing one can determine, to be really aware if you've been triggered into following some thinking, some line of thought. Just say, hang on, how did this start? Oh, I had that. And you trace it back. It's just an exercise in tracing back. Where did that come from? And it's often helpful recollecting in retrospect, because you will be able to remember, for the most part, if you catch it soon enough, that it was, you know, triggered through associated thinking connected to a perception, a memory perhaps, which may have been connected to a feeling tone or a mood. So this is a good exercise for the mind, because tracing back in itself in that way, it not only helps you begin to understand the conditions that give rise to certain experiences, but actually the process itself establishes one-pointed attention and mindfulness. So in my own practice, when I find the mind is restless and caught up in thinking, I've found that it's often because my body is not comfortable or not relatively comfortable. Most of the time it is not comfortable these days. But if it's at a certain level of discomfort, then somehow it makes the mind restless, just because it can't settle into a degree of tranquility or serenity, or just be comfortable in this body. So what I do is, once I recognize that, I try to recognize the painful feeling in the body. It might just be, you know, indigestion, or it could be a pain in the back or the neck or the knee. And really recognize, really bring my focus to this unpleasant sensation or painful sensation. And much of the time as I do that, and obviously you can bring this quality of metta and acceptance to this painful feeling tone, of this painful sensation, because it's actually the unconscious resistance to the pain that is fueling the restlessness, fueling this kind of unconscious restless thinking. Because at other times when the body is comfortable and relaxed and tranquil, the mind is very happy to be with it because it's pleasant. So there's a lot of unconscious, you know, kind of averting of one's attention happening. Just habitual averting attention from unpleasant or painful feeling. So this we need to become conscious of. And as you become conscious of this, you're establishing mindfulness of Dhamma as well as mindfulness of body, because what you're becoming aware of is the First Noble Truth of Dukkha. You're sending your attention to find where it is, become aware of the sensation. You're actually applying an antidote. If you're recognizing resistance, explore, can I soften around this? Can I be kind to this body, this heart, this sensation? Can I just, you know, whatever it is, you might actually become aware that you have some pretty strong expectations of yourself, you know, and you're holding yourself quite stiffly and you're telling yourself you should do this and you should do that, and think, oh, hang on, just let go of that a bit, soften around it, just be kind to this being that's been through a lot. And as you start to soften and give metta to this painful sensation or this experience you're having, then you actually recognize how you've been holding your body, often very habitually, but holding it in a tight way, in a forced way, and that this in itself creates discomfort and painful feeling, and it has a reverberating effect into the mind. So we're subtly escaping, trying to escape, but only creating more dukkha. So yeah, there's so much learning within that, you know. So quite typically, probably one of the most difficult hindrances is the restless mind. It stimulates thinking. So to recognize restlessness, come out of the thought, recognize it in your body. So when you close your eyes and you shut down those other sense doors for a while, then, you know, attention is going to nestle in with that habitual thinking mind, isn't it? So give it something else. Maybe open your eyes for a bit. Let your attention rest on the floor in front of you, a meter or two, or on the shrine. And as your eyes are open for a bit, just pay attention to the quality of space in the room. And the first time I experienced this is actually in an art class when I was about 16, when the teacher told us to, you know, we'd set up some kind of still life scene. He says, I want you to paint the space around that still life. We'd been used to painting the objects. Forget the objects, paint the space. So you really had to look at the space. You know, we'd been training our eyes to look at the form of objects and the light of objects and the structure of objects to replicate that. But now it's subtle difference, but a profound difference is look at the space and paint the space, forget the objects. And the result was very interesting. Your objects still come out on the drawing or the painting because you've painted the space. You've, by default, given definition to the objects, but they're defined through space, not the other way around. And actually the quality of the painting is quite different, but the most profound thing was the training of one's perception to notice the difference. And that our perception, our attention is so used to noticing objects, where they're just caught on objects, and thoughts are literally just objects of the mind. And they're not constant, they're not so thick that we can't see the beginning and endings of thoughts. Sometimes it feels like that. But if we determine to notice the space between the thoughts, here you've got another way of working with the thinking mind. Just like you can determine to be like that cat at the mouse hole, waiting for the next thought to emerge, so you can determine, I'm going to notice the gaps between the thoughts as a way of working with the thinking, habitual thinking mind. And if you do this, it can also be very profound, very helpful, noticing the space or the gaps between the thoughts. And I think quite a few teachers, I've heard a couple of different teachers also say that try intentionally taking one of the thoughts that are bothering you and intentionally slow it down. Say it to yourself very slowly, each word, each syllable, very slowly. So you're actually using, you know, if you've got a particular obsessive thought or someone that you're thinking about or something that you're thinking about, then pick it up and work it in this way, very deliberately, very slowly. You're showing it to your mind in a whole other form. It's a bit like deliberately painting the space, not the object. So you're not discarding the scene or the still life or the thoughts, but you're picking it up in a very different way because you're determined to get to know it and to show the mind that there is more to this than what it's used to following, what it's used to seeing. So you can see these are different ways you can work with the thinking mind or mindfulness. You can be very creative with it, actually. You can find different ways of working with what you're finding as a particular obstruction. So be determined to get to the truth of it, to see it really for what it is. So you've got these different approaches, and all of this will develop wisdom. When you develop this paying attention to the space element, it can be really helpful for bringing a lot more space between thoughts. So you can take that out when you're outside as well, to really notice a space element, or looking at the sky, for example, and that's a practice in the Tibetan, in the Dzogchen tradition, sky gazing. because it really affects perception. It it can help us see that you know, really the mind is often compared to the sky, the sky-like nature of the mind, and the thoughts, the thinking, the various things that pass through the mind are compared to the clouds that move through the sky. And because our attention is just used to noticing the clouds, they've become very familiar clouds, and we have strong feelings in relation to them sometimes, whether we like them or dislike them. But even when the sky is full of clouds, the sky is actually still there. And we've got to remind ourselves of that as well. Even though it might feel like the mind is bombarded by thoughts, just recollecting that metaphor that, okay, maybe the mind, like the sky, is covered in clouds, maybe stormy clouds at the moment with strong wind moving it through. But does that mean the sky is no longer there? It doesn't. And similarly, we can look at the mind, the awareness that knows these thoughts, that knows the turbulence of the mind, is as spacious as the sky. That which knows, that which can observe, that which can see, metaphorically see internally. The storm of those thoughts are happening within a context, if you like, within the space of this mind. Awareness like space. Another way you can, I'll just give one more suggestion, which is also very helpful depending on your tendencies, but I find it helpful when I'm in my kuti for a while and practicing. If a mind is a little restless, I just sometimes just read a line or two of Dhamma. Or you can even, if you've got some recording, guided meditation, because that ability to listen, or that when you're in listening mode, just notice when you're in listening mode, to hear something, to understand something, thoughts generally are not present. Because you're, again, a bit like that cat waiting at the mouse door. When you're listening and you want to understand something, we make the mind very open to wait for that sound, to understand something. So listening is very close to that quality of spaciousness. It opens the mind door, opens the mind. Through reading something, for me, because I'm quite inquisitive and I like inquiry, so reading something will just give my mind that focus to ponder an aspect of Dhamma. And then I've turned the kind of everyday restlessness into inquiry into Dhamma, and then inevitably when I'm inquiring into Dhamma, it brings the mind to a still point. Why? Because Dhamma usually turns the mind back on itself to observe. If I read something, I say, well, how is that in me? How do I understand that in me? Where do I find that in this process of body and mind? So I can truly understand what it's pointing to, not just intellectually, but know it in this experience, because that's how wisdom arises. And so it turns me back to observing. And when we observe, when we watch something, when you watch Wanda eat, do you have crazy thoughts when you're watching Wanda enjoy a banana?
Really?
You just have this open mind, enjoying watching this wonderfully weird looking creature enjoy some breakfast. My mind goes that way anyway. And there's the joy of seeing her enjoy it, but also the joy of, not thinking. So that's another thing to do. Notice during the day the kinds of things that allow you to, or notice when you do have an empty mind, a mind empty of thoughts. When you're watching an echidna, or watching the wallaby, or watching the birds, or listening to something. So these are all very important and powerful indicators for applying practice internally. Well, it's, you know, it is practice. When you're noticing that, it's already practice, but when it comes to maybe sitting meditation and you feel assailed by thoughts, that's when you have to work your wisdom. You have to remember what it was that worked and start to work it, start to experiment, explore. And this is just developing the skill of practice, developing wisdom, learning from the difficulties, learning from what doesn't work as much as we do from what does work, learning how to apply that in this mind and heart, because each of us are a little bit different. We've got to figure out how it works for us. And the Buddha did say that this practice of Dhamma is a gradual path and a gradual process, that realization or fruition doesn't come all at once. And he compared it to the ocean floor that gradually slopes away down into the deeper ocean. He said, so this Dhamma, this teaching, this training is a gradual sloping path towards the deathless. So the more we train, the more we understand this body-mind and how to work with it, and be brave enough to work it yourself, to find your own solutions. Because we have to translate it. The words in the books or the words of other teachers are honed from different times and different places through different minds. We can glean something from that, but ultimately we have to translate it ourselves in our own hearts through our own experience. And in this way, you'll come to that realization that the Buddha's pointing to, and we'll truly know, fully understand the conditioned and the unconditioned, because really it's through understanding what the conditioned is that reveals the unconditioned. So hopefully there's something in there to help you with your cultivation, and I'll offer these thoughts for our reflection.